right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've got a hell of a show for you today. And I know I say that each and every week, but each and every week I really mean it, and most of the time we come through, right? Yep, that's right. I hear you all saying, yep, that's right, man, that's right. What we got in store for you today is basically what we're going to be doing is we're going to be talking about the soundtrack to the revolutionary upsurges, the songs of rebellion that rocked the 60s and the people that made those songs, all right? At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with jazz musician David Murray. Now, this interview with David Murray is from a conversation I had with him at a concert up in Harlem back in April of 2011. And David was playing at that concert, which was on the occasion of the publication of Basics, Bob Avakian's new book, Basics, A Celebration of Revolution and the Vision of a New World. And I thought it'd be very interesting to listen to David Murray as someone who came up out of that period of the 60s, who was shaped by his experiences in the 60s and the whole development of revolutionary movement, and to this day remains a very accomplished and very progressive jazz musician in the world, active on the world scene. Opening the show up, though, we are going to be talking with, and I'm very pleased to have them, we're going to be talking with both Pat Thomas, who is the author of Listen, Whitey, The Sights and Sounds of Black Power, 1965 to 1975, and Ricky Vincent, who's the author of Party Music, The Inside Story of the Black Panthers Band and How Black Power Transformed Soul Music. I have had the greatest amount of fun in the last week reading these books, digging into listening, thinking about things, going, what? You know, sometimes you go, what the hell are they saying? Oh, my God, really that? These are two cats, man, I got to tell you. On the phone with us right now is Ricky Vincent. Ricky, welcome to the show.
Hey, happy to be here.
Good to have you, man. And sitting across from me, and he's just sitting there, and he's like looking all cool and everything else, right? And I'm thinking, okay, this cat, this is his book was an awesome book, and I think people should really, both of these books, you know, these are things you don't want to miss. And Pat Thomas is my guest in studio.
Yeah.
There you go. Pat, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Sure. And let me tell. Pat.
Hey, Ricky.
Okay, now. You guys can't cut me out of the conversation.
Okay.
We'll just start talking.
Exactly.
There you go. I knew this was going to happen. Let me say right now what this is going to be. It's got Ricky's book, Party Music, and it explores the relationship of soul music to the black liberation struggle in the 1960s from the vantage point of the musicians and black revolutionaries themselves. And it introduces us to the Black Panther's own band, The Lumpin', a group composed of rank-and-file members of the Black Panther Party. Also, I would add, who were, in fact, musicians and artists in their own right. And
they were accomplished.
Yes, exactly. And Ricky provides an insider's account of the politics and soul music aesthetics and reveals more details than ever before. And Pat's book, Listen, Whitey, The Sights and Sounds of Black Power, 1965-1975. Pat is a music producer and scholar. He spent 5 years researching Listen, Whitey. And I tell you, you know, I'm amazed that it only took him 5 years to do this because this is like just visually and information-wise, both of these books are just powerhouses. Pat's book is based on interviews with members of the Black Panther Party and rare recordings of speeches, interviews, and music. Pat is also a musician. God, Pat, I got to go through this, man. You're a musician, a producer, a music scholar, and an A&R consultant for Light in the Attic Records in Seattle. Damn, man, when do you get time to sleep?
Well, I don't.
Okay, Rick, so a lot is going to be riding on you right now, okay? All right. Hey, Teddy, let's play that track you started out with, and we'll just give people a sense of this. This is, well, I'll let you listen to it for a little bit, and then we'll come back and talk. Now you can bring that down, Teddy, and we can just let it ride a little bit under us, man, because this is just a killer piece. Now this is the band, The Lumpin', you know,
that's
and
right.
this is for people, and I think I'm willing to bet there's a whole hell of a lot of people that have never heard this or heard of The Lumpin', you know, and I wanted go ahead, Rick.
Well, it's a very little known story, and it's also something that was so sort of implausible for what we expect when we hear about the Black Panther Party. Members of the Black Panther Party were militants. They were heavy-duty brothers and sisters. And, yeah, they might have softened up and did the Breakfast for Children program, but they stood up to the man, and people understood. They sort of hear those references, Off the Pigs, Power to the People. They hear these references all the time, and so they don't expect an organization like the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense would put together a rhythm and blues band. And even if they did, it sort of would get forgotten because the image of the Panther remains with us, and it's a whole different image. It's these no-nonsense soldiers. But what happened was these guys were rank-and-file members. They joined for the revolution, but they also were talented, and so when they were doing some of their busy work for the party, people could hear them making up songs as they went, and said, you guys are pretty good. Why don't you try to, you know, give us a few, try a few songs, and everything they did sort of clicked, and Emory Douglas, the Minister of Culture of the party, still one of the most important spokespersons for the vision of the Black Panther Party today, at the time, you know, he saw what they were doing. He said, you guys, get some equipment and put a band together. He had to go to the Central Committee of the Black Panther Party, go to the main meeting and say, we need equipment for a band. And they approved it. And they said, well, if this will reach the people, do it. And they did it. So these were card-carrying, rank-and-file Black Panther Party members who wrote and performed a concert's worth of music. They performed a lot of music, but they recorded this one single called Free Bobby Now. It's about Bobby Seale, who was in prison at the time. He was on two trials, Chicago 8 trial and the trial in New Haven, which you can get a lot of in both Pat Thomas's book and my book, the sort of backstories to all of that. But they wrote that song, and they performed it, and that's a single. And you can get it off of Pat's CD, the Listen Whitey CD.
Mm-hmm. Now, Pat, what was your take on the lumpin'?
Well, Ricky to me is Mr. Lumpin'. I mean, he, wrote, in my mind, the definitive book. But there's something that one of the lumpens said. I think it was Michael Torrance. He said, not everybody reads newspapers, but everybody listens to music. And so to me, the lumpen are carrying on this literally centuries old tradition. Used to have the town crier. He might show up in the middle of the market square, in 1642, and literally sing the news, if you will. And also, the lumpen are carrying on topical protest songs. I mean, they're in a lineage with even somebody like Bob Dylan, writing The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll and things like that.
Now, Rick, tell me something, man, because there's a point you decided for, your book was about the intersection, and the same with you too, Pat. Your books are about the intersection of the political movement at the times, the revolutionary movement that was rocking the country like it had never been rocked before,
right,
at the times, and the intersection of that and culture and music and art, the things that actually, and the impact that it had on each other. But why then look at the lumpen, who frankly, when people hear them, they're really always blown away because, as you guys were saying, they were accomplished, they're very good. But at the same time, they were so little known, in a certain sense. But they were known and loved by a very important section of people at that time. Why did you frame your book with the lumpen?
Well, you see, at the time, when I was looking into the two different, sort of strands of the 60s black revolution, if you will, it had to do with black power politics, whether you're talking about Stokely Carmichael or Huey Newton or Ron Karenga or any of those people, black power politics. And to me, the other revelation was soul music and what was happening in the music on the radio in terms of Aretha Franklin's Respect and James Brown's Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. But a lot of people were immersed in the black radical jazz of that time. And so there's a lot of literature on the jazz movement, although not at anywhere as close to the radical treatment that Pat Thomas gives you on the jazz at that time. But there's most of those books about the sort of revolution in black music talk about jazz back then. But to me, my experience, and just looking at the lineage of soul music, it was the black awakening of the 60s that inspired all this incredible music from Curtis Mayfield, from James Brown, from Everyone, Otis Redding. I mean, you didn't have to have an explicit revolutionary message to have music that, you know, made you feel the power that you had. Sam and Dave's Soul Man, that's a universally appealing song, but to black folks, it was celebrating race and culture in the black community. And so there was all this music that spoke to a movement that was taking place, if you were willing to listen, if you're willing to decode it, if you will, because people could understand. And of course, the godfather of soul, James Brown, was making it plain. This is what the music is for. It's soul power. It's music, you know, to give power to the people. He was listening to the Panthers, too. He was there. They were backstage with him, telling him, you better give us something, Mr. Brown, because, you know, we're on the streets with you. So all of these things were connected. They interacted. Everyone in the black community and everybody in the 60s lived both the music and the politics at the same time. And it's kind of crazy that your old school history texts give you like a political history and kind of skim the music, or you can get a music history that touches a little bit on the politics, but people lived them both. People went to, you know, heard speeches, and then they listened to the music on the radio on their way home from the speech. So all these things were connected. So it was a way to connect the revolution in the music and the revolution that was in the air.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would just add to that, you know, Ricky nailed it, but also, you know, if we flip over to the white counterculture, right, you have a synergy between Abbie Hoffman and the Jefferson Airplane. Jerry Rubin and Phil Oakes were great friends. Allen Ginsberg was a Yippie along with Paul Krasner. So you have this incredible synergy of young people, black and white, all plugged into the revolution. Obviously, white college kids protesting the war, Vietnam War, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a real, as Ricky said, it's a real vibrant time where music and politics intersected in a way that I don't think we've ever seen before or since.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask both of you this, and maybe and you know, we can start with you, Pat, and then move to Rick, since we've been giving Rick a lot of time here. But here's a question for both of you. You know, in Rick's book, and I think it runs through your book as well, Pat, the fact that you speak about the concept of black power as it emerged and as part of the movement for revolution at that time, the revolutionary movement at that time, centered around, and particularly in relation to the Panthers, but broader than that as well. You know, you talk about that, the transformation of the music scene at that point, that there was a transformation of the music scene, but it also had some impact. There was a back and forth. Like, on the one hand, the movement was really transforming music and soul music in a way that, you know, I mean, soul music came to mean something completely different. And, you know, what was accepted as standards in the past, even including jazz, which was actually, as you were talking about, there was a certain niche, even though it was more popular than it is today, there was a certain niche that it had. But there was something about the emergence of soul music and the way that it emerged in that time period that both, I mean, you know, that people talk about it. And I think, Rick, you say it in your book at some point that it transformed, you know, that basically it basically made soul music, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, but it made soul music something very different and very vital to the world at that point. And it also had some impact on the revolutionaries and the revolutionary movement as well.
That's right.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, one of the things, you know, that I realized right in my book, and this is kind of obvious, but probably none of us ever really think about it, Aretha Franklin's Respect is a number one hit single on both soul and pop charts. So here's a black woman demanding respect, and that's a number one song. And that's a pretty remarkable feat if you sit back or you know, kind of transform yourself back to when that hit the charts. You know, as Ricky pointed out, you know, James Brown, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. You know, you've got Sly Stone, you know, making incredible statements, Stand, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there's just this incredible synergy, you know. And then, of course, you know, a story that's been told a million times, which is, you know, Marvin Gaye makes this incredible transformation from singing about love to singing about social political protests with what's going on. And, you know, like I said, it's just a real vibrant time. And yeah.
You know, there's something I want to hear from you in a minute, Rick, but there's something very interesting about that thing with Marvin Gaye, too, though, because, again, it speaks to what we're talking about now, because Marvin Gaye, you know, look, for myself even, you know, and I'm not like an idiot when it comes to music. I actually really pay a lot of attention to it. It's sort of like, it's like my blood, basically, right?
Yeah.
And, but at the same time, you know, Marvin Gaye and the Four Tops.
Well, let's you know what, since we're on Pacifica Radio, I think this is a great little story to tell that many listeners may not know, which is that one of the Four Tops, and Rick might remind me which one it was.
Bobby Benson.
Right. The Four Tops are playing in the Bay Area, and the People's Park protests are starting to happen. And so he starts to carve out a song centered around People's Park. Now, you know, he's not a real prolific songwriter and, you know, kind of needs a little work. He actually runs into Joan Baez, I believe, at the BBC in England or somewhere on a stage in England, and plays it for her as a skeletal piece. And of course, you know, Joan loves protest songs like nobody else. But for whatever reason, that didn't connect. And then the next thing you know, he's playing it for Marvin Gaye and another gentleman. And the whole thing sort of takes off from there.
Urban.
Right. And so it's kind of cool to think that what's going on actually originally stems from the People's Park movement in Berkeley. I mean, that's fascinating.
Well, also just that, I mean, look, it does say something about what happens to people when this kind of upsurge is out there, how it changes the terms for everybody's thinking. I mean, it's interesting. I interviewed David Murray about 2 years ago, and he was at this, he was playing at this event to celebrating the publication of Bob Avakian's book, Basics. And there was a whole lot of people up there, and David was playing, and I was interviewing him, and he talked about, well, you know, I read Avakian's memoir, and one of the reasons I'm here is because we share a lot in common in terms of coming up. And then he told this story. He said, I went to this high school. I can't remember the name of the middle school that he was at. And he said, I was in middle school when People's Park was happening. And I went out there, and we all went out into the schoolyard, and we were having lunch and playing and all this stuff. And all of a sudden, there were helicopters coming by, and they started to gas us.
Right.
And he said, and it was because they thought they saw a group of youth, and they said, People's Park, gas them. Right?
Yeah.
And that kind of thing that happened that really changed people's lives in a very dramatic way. You know, Rick, I wanted to ask you about this thing about, you know, that, again, that as you said, yes, very, you know, enthusiastically about this sort of the interplayer, that the interconnection between the impact of the movement on the music and the music on the movement.
Well, see, these things were so concurrent, you can look at it generally, or you could just break it all the way down. When Pat talked about Aretha Franklin's Respect, that record came out the first week of May of 1967. If you go look at your Black Power history, the Black Panthers walked into the Sacramento State Capitol brandishing their rifles on May 2nd, 1967.
Damn.
So when people were looking at these photos and the headlines saying Negroes invade state capital, and you know, folks on the street are like, hey, the revolution's come, they turn on the radio and they're hearing R-E-S-P-E-C-T. They're hearing this. That was you know, the breakout track. That was the soundtrack to that experience. And for folks that remember everybody remembers the Black Power fist at the Olympic Games in 1968, in October of 1968, when John Carlos and Tommy Smith, raised the Black Power fist on the Olympic podium. Well, that was October of 1968. The number one R&B song was James Brown's Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. So both of those things were happening to the people at the same time. So you know these events are going to really sink in deeply. And so the artists would feed off of these events, and then their work would in turn, you know, galvanize and just glue together all the subsequent activities. So the two things work together in a way that, it, like I said, it's the lived experience that people had. Why people didn't get it or the story wasn't told that way, it's pretty fascinating. To me, it took the hip-hop generation to kind of remind people that, you know, people sort of come up living through the rhythms of their time. And so this generation, the hip-hop generation, sort of learns the world through its music, through its rhythms. And you can look at the revolution that way. You can look at the Black Revolution through the music and through the rhythms and see how people went through this awakening and put the Negro to bed, and a black man and woman was born.
Mm-hmm. I was telling Pat before we got on, I think I mentioned it earlier when we opened it up, I had the most fun this week. I couldn't stop reading. I'm reading Rick's book, and I'm going over real quick, going to Pat's book, and I'm just like...
Well, yeah, one of the things I want to say is I sometimes describe my book as the warm and fuzzy side of the Black Panther Party. And what I mean by that is, you know, if the Panthers were walking down the streets with guns, that was front page news. when they fed school children, that's not front page news. Doesn't make good for front page news copy. When they had free ambulance service, because many of the ambulances would not go into the urban ghetto parts of many cities in the United States. The other thing is that my book is not a political book as much as it's a cultural book. It talks about the Panthers in the context of, for example, the Partridge Family of all. And people are scratching their heads right now going, what the hell does that mean? The Partridge Family, their first season, 1970, 71, I believe, there's actually an episode where the Partridge Family, David Cassidy, Shirley Jones, get lost in the back streets of Detroit. They run into Richard Pryor and Lou Gossett Jr., who's running a soul club. And they're expecting the Temptations to show up for a gig. It turns out the Temptations are not going to make it. David Cassidy says, I've got a Afro pop tune for you. The next thing you know, little Danny Bonaducci is walking the streets of Detroit. He runs into a bunch of Panthers, and they say, hey, we play violins. Kind of odd, but Panthers say we play violins. And you have these actors dressed in berets, right? And this is, you can see this on YouTube, folks. You can Google Partridge Family Soul Club. But the point is that the Black Panthers and the Black Power movement in general became so iconic that even Hollywood had to pay some sort of recognition that this movement existed, even if it was in some sort of bizarro way.
Mm-hmm. And the bizarro way was a process of neutralizing some of the radical elements. That's what a lot of the blaxploitation films were about. They sort of made a clown show out of Angela Davis and Eldridge Cleaver and Huey Newton with Superfly and Coffee and Shaft and things like that. They were thrilling. They were entertaining and they were comic, but they also sort of took the meat off, took the bite out of some of what these movements did to put these narratives into the American lexicon in the 60s, and then the pop culture kind of did everything it could. You know, it's whether it's conscious or not, it's what happened. It started to absorb these radical elements.
Well, let me ask you this, you know, because one of the things that actually came up, let's talk about this, the backup band for the Lumpin'. Now, you had the Lumpin', who were rank-and-file party members, were also artists in their own right and accomplished, as singers. We've been talking about, singers, right? Mm-hmm. But then you had this band that actually was a multinational band in terms of, you know, people being, you know, white people, black people. But it also, you know, you had that. And then you also had a number of people who, very accomplished musicians, who were really drawn to the Panthers. Let's talk about that.
Well, see, this is where that connection lies. And you said, at the top, you know, why would I frame a book around a group like the Lumpin'? Well, you know, these Panthers, they knew what the people would connect to, and they were connecting to the fire that's in soul music at that moment in 1970. And when they were ordered to get a band, they took about two phone calls, and they called some high school friends. You have to remember, most of the Black Panther Party members are from 17 to 20 years old anyway, and they're fresh out of high school. Some are still in high school. And so, can you play? He said, can I play? I'll be there. Where do I play? And a lot of people at that time in that generation, you know, would play anywhere for free anyway. So the thrill of playing in support of the Black Panthers, that was as hip as it gets. I mean, they didn't call it radical chic, but it was the hip thing to do, to be down, you know, with Huey and Bobby's party if you came up in the East Bay streets. That was it. And so it wasn't hard to find band members for this group. Now, the trick was keeping them, because after a few gigs, you know, they would realize they're playing some pretty radical music. The FBI would follow them. There would be harassment. They would be treated as Panthers, as enemies of the state. And so some of them wouldn't last, and they'd have to go back home and recruit some more. That wasn't hard to do. It's, you know, this generation, it's hard to find a whole group of musicians that are willing to make those sacrifices and still have, you know, real perfectionist standards musically. But that's always been the tradition until recently. That's what people did. They studied the music, not necessarily for fame and glory, but, you know, to be able to produce something meaningful out of it. And so that was an opportunity for some folks that were in the East Bay to really play. I want to play some music, but I really want to say something, and that was an opportunity to do it. Some of those people, Minor Williams, he's a cousin of Lenny Williams, a famous singer in Tower Power. A bass player named Melvin Coleman played with them and wound up with this R&B group called The Whispers for 30 years. And he recently retired. And there's another guy named Raheem Roach who went on to play with Sun Ra after this. And the one of the Lumpin' singers, after he got himself out of the party, which was a crazy experience for Michael Torrance, it's in the book, he went on and went back into singing, and he was a backup singer for Marvin Gaye in 1974 when he recorded his famous live album and Distant Lover, the famous song where all the girls are screaming like crazy, Distant Lover. The background singers, one of them is a member of the Lumpin'. So, I mean, these are all high-quality, you know, skilled artists, but that was what was happening to that generation. So these are people that were musically gifted and musically inclined, and then the revolution took them over, and they decided to join the Black Panthers for reasons that had nothing to do with singing. But after a few years and the evolution of the party, which is explained in the book, you know, Huey Newton said, we need to reach back out to the community on terms the community can relate to. And, of course, music is one of the main ways.
Mm-hmm. Let's move into, there's a couple other things I wanted to talk about. And this was, again, and maybe we can start with you, Rick, and then we'll move over to Pat. But I wanted to talk about, you know, there's this whole sense of that comes through in both books of the broader influence, the broader impact of the movement, the revolution, the Panthers, and in the interplay with people like, even with the Lumpin', and there was a fascinating story somewhere, I can't remember which book it was in, but where they go up at on stage, maybe it was on yours, Pat, they go up on the last concert they did, I guess they went up and they told Curtis Mayfield, they were playing with Curtis Mayfield, and they went up and they weren't allowed to play. It was at San Quentin.
Well, it's got to be, yeah. Ricky's book. Yeah. He is Mr. Yeah. Lumpin', yeah. So yeah. He's got the best stories.
It was sold day at San Quentin.
That's it, that's
and,
it.
They were invited. Not unwittingly, people that they were known around the Bay Area as a musical group, but somehow the San Quentin officials didn't get the news that it was the Black Panther musical group, and so they went up there for a showcase with Muhammad Ali, Curtis Mayfield, and the Lumpin', and they thought it would be a nice way to entertain the inmates, and about a minute and a half into their first song, I think it was Bullets in the Air for Freedom, they pulled the plug and took them off the stage. But they actually brought, they had some female Panthers who dressed up as like just, you know, go-go dancers, as entertainers, you know, for the troops. But it was all, you know, sort of a mission to, you know, connect with the brothers there, because by then there was already a San Quentin Black Panther chapter. But people that were there talk about how, you know, kind of comic that whole experience was. But they did meet Curtis Mayfield, and William Calhoun, the leader of the Lumpin', said he had a conversation with him, and Curtis was all in support of what they were doing. Because the Lumpin' take the classic people get ready, and they flip it around, and they say people get ready, the revolution's come, you don't need a ticket, you'll need a loaded gun. That's what they say. And they, you know, but they harmonize it. They're very precise in their harmonies. And a song like Curtis Mayfield's "People," by the Impressions, "People Get Ready," you don't mess with that song. You don't make it a parody. You don't do something silly with it. You better sing it properly, or you're going to insult a lot of people. You're going to insult a tradition of protest music, of the blues. You're going to insult, you know, the gospel. You don't violate. Certain standards, and so the Lumpin' were definitely accomplished singers. He used soul music properly, but they use it to bring the message of the Panthers forward, and they would do it any way they could.
Mm-hmm. Now, and actually, it's interesting too, because there was a, you know, when you were talking about changing some of the lyrics and whatnot and all that, and one of the things, and we don't have to talk about this because I want people to read it, but one of the things that they messed with that I thought was just great was Old Man River becoming Old Pig Nixon. And I thought that was just a remarkable, remarkable switch up there. And there's a whole story behind it that I think people are going to have to get the book to get into. But let me ask you this. One of the things that I think, you know, for a lot of people who were around back in the 60s, as well as people who are new to things now, they look at Bob Dylan and they have a whole different picture of Bob Dylan and his relationship to society at large, they, you know, to what was going on at that time, to what's going on at this time. But there was a really interesting relationship between Dylan, the revolutionary movement, the Panthers in particular, and Huey and Dylan. Let's talk about that a little.
Yeah, that's a lot of Pat Thomas's really primary research. And he kind of laid that mold out. And so he should speak on that.
Okay. Well, the front cover of Listen, Whitey is a 1970-era picture of Huey Newton holding Bob Dylan's Highway 61. And each week, as the newspaper, the Black Panther newspaper, was being laid out, Huey would insist that that album be played. He was particularly into the song Something's Happening, But You Don't Know What It Is, Do You, Mr. Jones? And Huey actually wrote a long...
Ballad of a Thin Man.
Ballad of a Thin Man, thank you. About how he saw Dylan's sort of obtuse lyrics as actually a social protest message. And that's a fascinating read. Dylan, like I said, he'd obviously written Blown in the Wind, Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll, Emmett Till. And then, as we all know, you know, as Bob smoked a little weed and expanded his consciousness, he got into things like a Rolling Stone and songs that were not necessarily politically motivated. By 1971, Bob is under pressure from sort of what you might call the underground counterculture. A.J. Weberman, of course, is on his butt. Phil Oakes, Jerry Rubin saying, hey, Bob, you need to make a political statement. When George Jackson is shot down, within less than a week, Bob is in the studio recording this song. It comes out as a 7-inch single within 2 weeks of George's death. Now, Bob also, this was amazing, he knew that radio stations would not be eager to play the song George Jackson. So on the flip side is yet another version of George Jackson. So you don't have any choice. You want to play the new Dylan single, you're going to have to hear George Jackson. Now, one of the oddball things is, you know, there's been countless Dylan box sets, best of CDs. For whatever reason, Dylan has never put this song George Jackson back out again. And so when I was working on my book, I contacted Bob through some mutual friends, if you will. And within 24 hours, Bob came back to me and said, I endorse this project. And he gave me special permission. This song, George Jackson, is the only place you can get this song, is on my Listen Whitey CD. And when the book came out, Bob chose it on BobDylan.com as one of his favorite things. So anyway, without further ado, I think we should listen to this song.
I was just going to say that, Teddy. How about we do that, man? How about we play George Jackson? It's actually track two on that.
I woke up this morning, there were tears in my bed. They killed a man I really loved, they shot him through the head. Lord, Lord, they cut George Jackson down. Lord, Lord, they laid him in the ground. Sent him off to prison for a $70 rivalry. They closed the door behind him and they threw away the key. Lord, Lord, they cut George Jackson down. Lord, Lord, they laid him in the ground. He wouldn't take shit from no one. He wouldn't bow down on deal. Authorities, they hated him, because it was just too real. Lord, Lord, they cut George Jackson down.
All right, and that Lord, is, that's Bob Dylan and George Jackson. And we are going to take a couple, maybe a couple comments off of Pat. We've heard from you. Rick, what do you think about this?
That is an amazing piece of work. Everything around it, and this version is really starkly appealing too, because the band version maybe dilutes the message, and you could just feel, you know, how struck Bob Dylan was by this revolutionary. George Jackson was just a completely uncompromisable revolutionary, a person who became a revolutionary in prison and was one of the founders of the San Quentin chapter of the Black Panther Party, and was really articulate, and he was able to really express the convictions of folks that said, you know, this society completely has to change. And Bob Dylan had always sort of implied that in his music, that, you know, the time the change is going to come, the people are going to, who's on top is going to be on the bottom, you know, you're going to have to get ready for some serious change. And he was always sort of looking at these things in stark ways, and George Jackson sort of spoke Dylan's language, if you will, in terms of just how, you know, fundamentally, you know, out of balance everything is. So it's really interesting to find, to really witness the connection between those two. And the song brings it home. The whole story behind the song is very important. And I'm really struck, there's a verse at the end of the song where he said, you can just feel his despair. And he said, sometimes I think the whole world is one big prison yard. Some of us are prisoners and the rest of us are guards. And he really felt like this is the world. This is the world we're in. The world is a ghetto. That type of thing. It was really powerful, and this was, you know, Huey Newton was already down for Bob Dylan back in 1965, and this really sort of strengthened this connection. Although, you know, Pat can probably speak on how their encounter. They didn't really necessarily hang out with one another, but they really kind of spoke to one another across these other divides in society, because they both were really trying to transform a generation.
Exactly, a generation in the entire world. Now, we're going to have to cut that off here, but I want to say one thing, actually. I want to thank both of you guys for being here today.
Thank you.
Yeah. And Rick, thank you.
Thank you.
Sure.
And hey, folks, if you love that Dylan song, it's only on that CD.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Ricky Vincent, the author of Party Music, The Inside Story of the Black Panthers Band and How Black Power Transformed Soul Music, and Pat Thomas, the author of Listen Whitey, The Sights and Sounds of Black Power, 1965 to 1975, and both of those books are about the songs that rocked rebellions in the 1960s and early 1970s, and how that shaped the revolutionary movement, and also how the revolutionary movement really helped to shape the kind of music that was coming out and inspiring people here and all over the world. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, you'll be listening to an interview I did with jazz musician David Murray back in 2011. So stay tuned. That was Bow to the Black Man from David Murray. Back in April 2011, I was very, very lucky to be have the chance to both attend and to interview all of the artists at a concert that was held up in Harlem in April of 2011. And the concert was a celebration of the publication of Basics. It was on the occasion of the publication of Basics, Avakian's new book at the time. And the theme of the concert was On the Occasion of the Publication of Basics, a Celebration of Revolution and a Vision of a New World. And artists came from all kinds of, from every walk of life. There were dancers, there were singers, there were poets, there were rock musicians, there were hip-hop people. It was just, and there were a number of jazz musicians who really, you know, basically, I mean, they filled out a night like unlike any that I've been to in a long time. So this is an interview that I did with David Murray backstage at that concert. Why don't we talk about who you are and what you're doing here tonight?
Well, my name is David Murray, and I'm here to support Communist Party and Bob Babakian, who's a kindred spirit. I don't know him personally, but after reading his book, you know, things he was talking about are similar situations that I experienced in the same area, in Berkeley, California. I mean, and you know, it was also interesting that he was actually from Fresno. My people from Fresno too.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, so we share that in common. Yeah. I just seen a lot of common things in him and myself and the Bay Area and the TOC, the fact that he liked basketball and he liked football. He talked about the football program at Berkeley High, which I experienced a lot. Me and my brother were pretty good athletes as well. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing about Cal and the whole thing about racism in Berkeley and all of that, I experienced all of that just a few years after him. Mm-hmm. I'm 56. I don't know what age he's seems to be about. I imagine he's about 60 now.
Yeah, I think he's in his 60s. Yeah. Now, so you, when you were growing up in Berkeley, and you grew up in Berkeley itself?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, when you were growing up in Berkeley, what was the impact? What was the scene like then?
Well, what the things that he talked about in the book, he was talking about People's Park. Mm-hmm. When People's Park happened, I was at Willard Junior High School. And the thing that was phenomenal about that was at that time, Ronald Reagan was the governor. And it was a friend of mine had gotten shot in the foot with some of these buckshots. They were using buckshots on people. And there was an incident that happened where, you know, when they used to call in the county sheriffs and all that, they came in and they marched in our school. They put tear gassed our whole school. And they made a big mistake, in fact. I mean, the People's Park is like, well, four blocks up Telegraph towards Southergate from Willard Junior High School. And the baseball field might have resembled People Park, People's Park. So I think what happened was that we were out having lunch, kids out, you know, in the park, in the baseball field and in the green part of Willard Junior High School, mm-hmm. having lunch. Mm-hmm. And they tear gassed us from the sky. And we're like 12, 13-year-old kids, you know, these 7th and 8th graders. And they thought it was People's Park. They missed. And this really pissed us off. And I was the president of the student body at that time. And so, you know, we were talking about, well, hey, okay, they tear gassed up. We going up to People's Park now. I mean, mm-hmm. we had an excuse. We were all eyes, you know, crying. And, you know, we became revolutionaries because they struck us first. Mm-hmm. And we're kids. I mean, my son is the same age now, you know, and I can't imagine him being tear gassed by some county sheriffs that's so stupid that they're trying to tear gas People's Park, which is further up the street, my friend, but they get Willard Junior High School. And I think they turned us all into revolutionaries at that moment.
Yeah, sometimes you gotta wonder, because even, you know, you can, who knows whether they made a mistake or they just looked down and said, or even if they made a mistake, it was just to hell with it, let's just go with it, you know?
I think they were so stupid that just made a mistake.
that's a good point.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this, because you also, so you started to really question things and become, like you said.
So that was the beginning of our revolution right there. And then... And then the second thing that happened, that was 1968. The second thing that happened was Martin Luther King got killed right in that time. And me being the student body president, I had to heal a lot. I remember I was playing a gig at Trimble some years ago out there at the jazz club, mm-hmm. Trimble's. And a cat came out the blue. And he started telling my girlfriend at the time, he says, you know, David saved my life one time. And I said, what do you mean I saved your life? He says, well, you remember when we was in the hallway and those dudes was going to kick my ass after Martin Luther King died? And then you said, leave him alone because he's on the basketball team? I said that? He said, yeah. I said, okay, well, I didn't mean to save your life. I said, let your ass bleed. No. But he's a funny cat. We went out and had.
Well, here's a question for you about that. Because, you know, that at that point, those are things that began to shape your views when you're very young.
Yeah.
You know, and then that goes into your music.
Well, yeah, and it's the same year that I started reading. I remember I was reading Beneath the Underdog, the Charlie Mingus book. I started reading really heavy stuff during that time, and I just wanted to get, because I was already a musician. You know, I already had a band. Mm-hmm. You know. I had a trio already, you know. I mean, I always knew what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to be up standing in front of the band playing my sax. I knew I was going to be doing that. So I was just trying to read everything I could, you know. And being a student body president, I had a lot of access to a lot of things. And our school was kind of a model school system. So we were dealing with racism in a I think, very positive way in Berkeley. Unlike Oakland and Richmond, you know, it was different. Segregation was still happening, and it was it, even though they, you know, it, it the time had not really come yet.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and you're listening to an interview I did with jazz musician David Murray back in April of 2011 at a concert celebrating the publication of Bob Avakian's new book, Basics.
Now, let's kind of, you know, I know also you, somebody told me when I was talking with him, I told him I was going to come and see the event with you and that you were going to, you know, there was a possibility of interviewing you, and they said, you know, David Murray was a good friend of Horace Tapscott's.
Well, I knew Horace. I wouldn't say I was a good friend of him, but I would have probably been a more of a friend, and I probably would have played with him more had I lived in Los Angeles proper. But I was in college, at Pomona College. I had gotten a state scholarship to go there, so I wasn't able, you know, I wasn't able to play with his band. Arthur, my mentor, one of my mentors, was playing with him. I knew a lot of people who played
Arthur
with him. Yeah. I knew a lot of people who played with them, but I was mostly, you know, in Pomona. I mean, Claremont, you know. I knew Horace, and I love Horace. And Horace is he's an influence, but not as close as some people would think. And, you know, it's funny because it's funny, when he came to New York, he turned the story around a little bit and said that I was a little closer to him than he might have, I might have actually been, because I was a kid. I was 18 and 19, and I wasn't really there in LA that much, because on the weekends I was trying to work in other places, and I had some gigs, you know. I was going to the Bay Area doing gigs on the weekend, and then I got a gig on Foothill playing with the society band, you know. I mean, music was always a way to make money, because, you know, my parents weren't going to be paying for that. I mean, even though you get a scholarship, you still have to pay.
Right, exactly.
And my parents weren't going to be paying nothing, you know. So my whole thing is, you know, music paid for the rest of it. And I had to work in order to do that. I wasn't like other kids. I always had a job since I was 12. I always had, you know, some kind of job in music, and I still do. That's what I do. That's why I don't take other jobs.
Well, the reason I even brought him up was because more like the sensibility that came through in terms of what weaves through your music in terms of your consciousness. And Horace had a lot of the same thing going on.
Horace is a great person. He's a great leader. And I learned probably a lot vicariously through him, but he wasn't my mentor. My mentor was Arthur Blythe. My mentor was Bobby Bradford. My mentor was Stanley Crouch.
Bobby Bradford, wow.
These are my mentors. And James Newton and I were their pupils.
James Newton, wow. We bring up all these names that are just...
Not just him, but Butch Morris and, you know, Wilbur. Wilbur was playing with them, Charles Tyler. But, mostly me and James were like the students of them.
But you've always, now, is this true? You've always seen your music having some connection with how you're hoping to shape the world?
Oh, yeah, you know, I mean, you look at titles. I think that's why I think titles are so important, you know. Every time something would happen in the world, I would write a song. Like, I remember when those the Hanafi sect of the Muslims, they took over this building in Washington. And I wrote a song called Holy Siege on Intrigue. And I did a little suite for that. You know, I remember when Dart Man was on the streets in New York, I wrote a song called Dart Man. I don't know. I was just like, you know, I mean, I was always going to be writing songs anyway. So I always look for a very intriguing title that would represent whatever was happening socially at the time. And when I lived in New York, especially, now, I don't do it so much now, but events always seem to shape the music. I mean, because I'm going to be writing music anyway. And so I always thought that the music, once I wrote a song, or once I was in the process of writing a song, something would be happening would make me start thinking about it. And then that thought process, I go to sleep and wake up. It's like you dream. It's like the way painters work, you know. You dream what that thing is, and next thing you know, you find the right words to express what that tune is. You find the right notes to express what that situation was. Next thing you know, it comes together and it becomes a song, and it actually does relate to social events. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I think that's important, because I always thought that musicians, we represent. I mean, if we're honest musicians, we should be able to kind of be a semaphore of the times that we're living in, mm-hmm. and represent. If somebody were to come and hear a capsule of our art and music, they would know our music might reflect the social ramifications of what was happening in the world at that moment. Mm-hmm. And I always felt like that's the kind of thing that I could channel through me, not particularly in a spiritual or in a revolutionary way, but whatever it comes out to be, and it ends up coming out to be that anyway. Mm-hmm. So it's just natural. Well, I mean, revolution is a natural for me, you know. That's why I tell the young people, you know, if young people don't protest about something, then they're like some kind of yuppie kids or something. They don't have no worth. There's nothing. As a generation, you got to get mad about something, I mean, other than your parents.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and you're listening to an interview I did with jazz musician David Murray back in April of 2011 at a concert celebrating the publication of Bob Avakian's new book, Basics.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's a question, because how does all that come to this event and your decision to actually take part in this? What was it that really pulled you into this?
Well, you know, it's all these, you know, everybody wants to say, well, you know, don't play here because of the Communist Party. They're going to put you on the list. And if they're still doing that kind of stuff, man, it's really too bad. It's really awful. It's a shame on America if it's still going to be in those times, if we're going to have a witch hunt. So I don't know how to say it, but I mean, the society, we're so far behind. I mean, the moment you say socialism in this country, they say, oh, he's a communist. You know, maybe they need to read some books or something. I don't know. Well, I feel like there's a lack of education about what communism actually is.
Yeah, and look, it's actually, I'm curious about this. Did anybody actually say to you, you shouldn't play this because there's communism involved?
Everybody I talk to says
really?
That.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, my friends.
Wow, wow.
I said, man, look, hey. I mean, what? Why would I? I'm 56 years old, man. If it's not gonna happen by now, it's not gonna happen, right, man. So I can do what I want to do.
Well, here's the question in terms of what you wanted to do. When people came to you with the idea of this concert being on the, and you had read Avakian's memoir and whatnot, but this concert being around on the occasion of the publication of his most recent book. And then it's a celebration of revolution and a vision of a new world. Was there something in that that just made you, that grabbed at your heart and said, I want to be part of this?
Well, like I said at the beginning of this interview, what made me want to do this is my kinship that I feel with Bob Avakian, even though I don't know him. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's because of things he talks about in this book about the Bay Area, and I related to every word. Every word is me. Wow. I mean, I've been feeling these things for a long time, and he expressed them. And even though I don't know him, I would like to know him, and maybe one day I'll meet him, and I hope he exists.
Yeah, he exists.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Okay, because I think he's a great man, you know. And he's not the first communist that I support. I support Amiri Baraka. He's also a communist, but I'm sure they don't see eye to eye. You know, I associate with many known communists. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not scared of that. Mm-hmm. Of this. It doesn't scare me in one way. You know, I'm not trying to be I'm not trying to run for office in Washington.
It's important that you take that kind of stand, though. It's very important in terms of, look, even in terms of what could possibly come out of this night, because right now we live in a world, in this country in particular, we live, like you're saying, you know, it's like people don't talk about revolution, and it's not allowed. It's ruled out of order. Thinking that there's a possibility to get a different world.
Well, they say that free speech is happening.
Mm. What do you think?
Well, you know, but everybody, all the small people. When I say small people, I mean my friends and people that I know, artists. Everybody's scared it up. Mm-hmm. Why is everybody scared it up? If it's free speech, mm-hmm. you know. Well, we can say anything we want to. Well, we can say it on the mic. Mm-hmm. Why won't we say it to the press? Mm-hmm. Why not?
Mm-hmm. One last question. When you think about what you'd like to see come out of tonight, what would that be?
That people hear each other's views and accept each other's on their... We accept each other on our, on different terms. Everybody's valid in their way of expressing their form of revolution. I mean, I live in France. It's a country where people go in the streets and manifest. Mm-hmm. That's what they do. Mm-hmm. Me, I personally don't want to be around there because they get pretty violent up there, mm-hmm. you know. But I'm with the young people. I mean, I'm with the young people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we may not see it in our lifetime, but maybe one day we're going to come up with a good idea.
I think that's a great way to end this.
Mm-hmm. All right, you've just been listening to an interview I did with jazz musician David Murray. And that was an interview that was conducted in April of 2011 at a concert up in Harlem. And it was a concert that was being held to celebrate the publication of Basics. That was Bob Avakian's book, new at the time. And the theme of the concert was, on the occasion of the publication of Basics, a celebration of revolution and a vision of a new world. So let me remind you once again that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank all of my guests today, Pat Thomas and Ricky Vincent. I also want to thank David Murray for the interview we did a couple years back, and I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and all of you for tuning in, all right? And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And I want to speak now to something that's been really, really, just really got me so angry and so much more determined to change this hellhole that we're living in, and that is the verdict in the murder of Jordan Davis case. And I just want to, you know, think. I want you to think about that. I want you to think about that on the occasion of the second anniversary of the murder of Trayvon Martin coming up. There's a call for a national hoodies up day on February 26th, and you should go to revcom.us to check out what's happening around the country. We're going to go out now with a very appropriate song from Bruce Springsteen. American Skin, 41 Shots.
41 shots cut through the night. You're kneeling over his body in the vestibule, praying for his life. Is it